The following talk was given by Steve Hagen at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on July 6, 2008. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to see you all. Well, 2 weeks ago, the last time I spoke here, I brought up the question, what is the most important thing? And I asked you that, those of you who are here. And different things were brought up. But then I pointed out, this is going to be the point of my talk, that for the awakened, the most important thing is this matter of just simply to be awake. Then I asked, what is the next most important thing? And again, more ideas were being offered. But as I pointed out once again, for the awakened, the next most important thing is to wake up. And it really is to wake up. I did say to be awake at first, and then I backtracked on that. I said that was kind of polluted, to be awake. Because it isn't a matter of some kind of stasis, you know. We awaken, then we claim some kind of identity there. I am awake, and I am a being awake. It isn't like that, you see. Next moment, whole new world, whole new situation. Whole new you. That's why we can't really find you. So once again, it is to wake up. So it is more like process. Somebody afterward asked me, then it's... So it isn't like being in a state, it's more like a process, yes. Because actually, if we look very carefully at our experience, we don't find any state as such. It is just continuous practice, continuous process. And in each moment, it is to just return to this, to come back, to come back, and come back, and to be awake. And then I asked, no, really, getting off into dangerous territory. I ask, why? Why is that the most important thing? To be awake or to wake up? Now we get into a little bit. We've shifted that question from what to why. And I talked a little bit then about how in Zen and in Buddhism, you know, the question really is what, not why. And why gets us into a bit of difficulty. When we ask why, we're kind of presuming, well, there's some entity there, several perhaps, and one offering a reason for the other. Once again, what is implicit, what is behind that questioning, that very question there, is a kind of a seeing things in terms of stasis, once again, or in terms of being or persistence. Whereas in each moment, what, we don't necessarily have to have that kind of ongoingness or presumed ongoingness, which is an illusion. But when we buy into that, then of course we're caught up in delusion. And our concern is to wake up. Not to get caught in something like that. So that's kind of what I talked about a bit last time. And questions came up too at the end about this matter of what and why. And I've talked on this before. I gave a talk with that very title, I think, a few years ago. So it's kind of a reoccurring theme, and there's many things we can say about that. But today, I think I want to go back to... Well, I wanted to say this, too, before I get into that. That in discussing the why, well, why? Why to be awake? Why is this the most important thing? And, of course, it's the most important thing, at least, to the awakened. It's not like it's the most important thing. I mean, this is it. Wake up. And the rest is all secondary. That'll all be taken care of in the best possible way, with awakening. But this question of why, and I did say a little bit about this, and this is kind of what I want to get more focused on now today, in today's talk. But I said that with this why question, if we look at it from the standpoint of the awakened, why is this an issue? Why is this important? Well, as I pointed out, the Buddha pointed out that there's these two situations here, two things that he points out, that he teaches, that he brings to our attention. And one is dukkha, and the other is release from dukkha. In the end, he said, this is what his teachings boil down to. I teach but two things, dukkha and release from dukkha. And of course, dukkha, for those of you maybe you don't know, dukkha, it's often translated in English as suffering, but it's much more subtle than just saying suffering. But it is this painful situation that we find ourselves in as human beings when we're not in awakening, when we're caught up in the delusion. And the delusion is such that often we don't even realize what that dukkha is or what the suffering is, but it is always there. If we quiet our minds down long enough, well enough, then we will see that it's actually, there it is. It's the backdrop of human existence. What we don't understand about that, I mean, it sounds hopeless if you put it in those terms, but what we don't understand about this is that actually existence is what we don't find, though. That's that being again. So were we to awaken in this moment, we are awakening to that reality that doesn't exist as such, nor does it not exist. I mean, here it is. It is just this reality here. But it is awakening to its true nature. And in this is the release from dukkha, from the confusion, the suffering, the pain, the vexation, the frustration and the fear, the longing and loathing. So if this is important to you, to find release from this, freedom from this kind of confusion and pain, well, to the awakened, this is what they're focused on. This is it. They would say, yeah, most important thing, except they don't use words. They don't say anything. Because when we really realize that this is the situation, then that's just get on with it right here in each moment. Wake up. That's what it really comes down to. So I want to say a little bit more about this and about this why question. Why be awake? Why is this important? You know, I'll look at this from a little different angle and I only kind of touched on this aspect. I was really talking about another aspect of all of this altogether in the last talk. But I want to focus a little bit more today on this matter then of why, and look at it maybe in a slightly different way. For that, I brought this book along because I wasn't sure I could remember the quote, but it was in, I used it in Buddhism, Plain and Simple. But this is a quote I think that will give us, something to work with here anyway, about this matter of why. Why anything, I suppose, but why be awake? And there's a quote here by a W. McNeil Dixon. He said, "Probably upon no subject ever discussed through the length and breadth of the globe has there been expended a fiercer hubbub of words than upon this, the foundations of morality. Why should I ask God to make me good when I want to be naughty?" asked the little girl. "All the wise men of the world are put to silence by this childish query. A parliament of philosophers will not resolve it. When we set out in search of an answer, we are lost." Yeah, this matter, this is the foundations of morality, he's saying. Difficult to come by, isn't it? Do we really find that? I mean, we can have commandments and rules and regulations, you behave this way and do that. But is this the foundation? Have we gotten to the foundation of this matter, morality? How to conduct your life in a way that is in harmony with reality itself? I think that's how the awakened would see it, that would be their concern. And to the extent that we can do this, out of that we can find this foundation, live out of this foundation, this basis of morality. But why can't we find it? Another why question there. Why is this so difficult? And I think he's kind of got some there. He said, a parliament of philosophers will not resolve it. And he said, all the wise men are put to shame, or put to silence. Well, maybe they ought to be ashamed if they can't see this. And maybe they're not fully wise if they can't see this, what this is. What is wrong here? What is wrong with this question? Well, it is kind of, the problem is, deals with this matter of why. The little girl asks, why should I ask God to make me good when I want to be naughty? You can imagine perhaps the frustrated, exasperated parents, this little girl, just be good and ask God to make you good. Why? Why would I want to do that when I want to be naughty, she said. And then we can't answer that question. I mean, we can offer things. But in the end, why? It seems to ring hollow. We don't seem to be able to get down to it. Well, it has to do with this very structure of why. And this matter of, as I pointed out, for the awakened, if we were to say why, well, why? Why wake up? Well, and they connect it to this problem of dukkha. There's dukkha and there's release from dukkha. Okay, well, where is this coming from? This isn't coming from the Buddhas, the awakened, giving us some dictum here, telling us, you should do this, you should be like this or that, and this will resolve this for you. Is more a matter that they have, if we're talking about one who is awake here, they see the nature of reality. And if we live in a way that violates that, or that's just not in sync with that, of course it's going to be painful. It's going to be difficult. There we have our dukkha. And if this is important to us, well, then maybe we should look into it a little bit. If we want to live free of endless vexation and pain and trouble and confusion, then maybe this is important for us to check into this and look at this. But when he says that philosophers can't resolve it, yeah, he said when we set out in search of an answer, we're lost. Of course we're lost when we search out an answer, because this question has been framed in terms of good and bad. The little girl, this is what she's been given. We've all been given that as children. There's good and bad, good and naughty, that sort of thing, good and evil. Framed off in this very stark dualistic framework here. And this is the good and this is the bad. And that's our whole life now. I mean, as human beings, we live with this framework in regards to everything that we look at. Not necessarily so much even in terms of good and evil and all, some of these bigger questions. But even in terms of what I like and what I don't like, in all sorts of lesser ways. There's a good person, a bad person. Just beings of mind have taken us away. And the quagmire we fall into here, the reason the philosophers can't respond to this, and the theologians and all the rest, when we have this, we'll be good. The reason we have a problem is, well, first of all, you can't really establish this good and bad. I mean, we'll start making some definitions. Or we'll say, well, God is good. Okay, now we're okay. All right. And then God says this or that. Okay. That's fine if you want to just follow some rules. But have we really gotten down to reality here? We just pulled out a term, a concept, an idea. Say God or even the concept of good. And now we're going to try to frame things up in response to that. Frame it. There's that old stasis again, that being, the constructed stuff. We do this. We just naturally do. We do this so easily. This is our thinking, our conceptual. Always living out of that, wanting to know, well, how should it be, and how should I be, and how should we act, and what are the rules, and what would a Buddha say about this? As if they think about all these details. They don't. They just see. And that's what this practice is about. That's what this teaching is about, is to help us wake up to what it is that we need to, well, wake up to. And to see. And it is more a matter of seeing the quagmire and the construction and all the rest of it, the things that we grasp and hold on to and fight with and grovel after and all of that. We're constantly occupying ourselves in that way. And out of this, we ask the question, well, why should this? I mean, we're not really, we've abandoned the big picture here. We've abandoned reality. We've abandoned the wholeness out of which we are living, or the reality of this life here, in which if we were to pay very careful attention, we would notice that, well, you really can't grasp anything here. Never could. But when we think we can, and that's what we're used to, and that's what we'll do, and we keep reaching. And of course, with all of that, if we look carefully, we'll notice, well, here I am, and I'm trying to get that to help my life here, and what should I do? And so the self is formed here as well. Constantly framing things up in this way in our mind and living out of that, not noticing that this doesn't match the actual dynamic reality that is truly being lived. And this is why we can't answer so basic a question as that. And why should I be good? We can't even establish what that good is. What do we mean by good? And that's that story, I guess I use it in this book too, of the wise Chinese farmer. I believe it comes from Taoist literature. The wise Chinese farmer, who, because he's wise, truly wise, awake, sees the situation. He can't see it in terms of this dualistic framework, good and bad. Well, what? In relation to what? So how does it go? His horse runs away, the neighbor says, oh, too bad. That's bad. That's too bad. Your horse ran away. And the wise farmer, he knows, is that bad? How can you establish good or bad, he says. Next day the horse comes back. Well, you know, and bringing other horses, with her. And, you know, well, I think most of you know that story, and it just goes on. Yeah, it seems like here's a good circumstance. Following on that comes something that, oh, this is bad and this is good. And, well, in the end, what do we have here? Because the whole picture, this is what we should not lose sight of. The awakened do not lose sight of this. This is all taking place in totality. But when we grasp, we want to know, is this the right way, the rule? You know, and if, now you're framing me. And of course, because we, in a kind of latent way, we're doing this all the time, is everything's framed up in terms of me. Well, of course, quite naturally from that follows the grasping. And there's just a that out there. And always trying to make the arrangement here that will somehow alleviate my suffering, make it most comfortable for me so I'm well protected and pleased. And it's just endless, endless, endless confusion. This is dukkha, as the Buddha identified. And he said, I teach but two things. He points it out. There is this dissatisfaction, this kind of endless suffering and confusion that goes on in our lives if we don't understand. So I teach dukkha, and I teach release from dukkha. But this release from dukkha comes with really getting very clear on what that dukkha is. Noticing the subtlety with which we are just living it out, moment by moment in our life. And we're just living right out of confusion. And it doesn't have to be that way. And there's your release. It really doesn't have to be this way. And it could end for you in an instant. Were you not caught up in the confusion? This is so important. It must be this way. I must have that. Or should I do this? It is endless. grasping the graspable thing, whatever it is, yourself, other things, ideas, thoughts, actions, not noticing the freedom and the dynamic reality that is unfolding moment by moment. That has, in a sense, nothing to do with you, really, other than the fact that there's this going on and you're showing up in it. But it isn't about controlling any of that. You can't. I can't. The Buddhas can't. Don't bother. We need to wake up to that and to see just what that is. And so if we get back to then to this question, well, why should I ask God to make me good? Well, if we just simply frame this in a different way, we don't have to frame this. You see, the looking for the foundations, the basis of morality, as he says here. We don't have to frame it up in good and bad, but we always do. We think this is morality has to do with things like that, the good and bad. That's what morality. But that's not a sound foundation, a sound basis for a morality or a moral system. It is to perpetuate the very confusion we live by. So what do we need to do? Well, we don't need to frame it up that way in terms of good and bad, good and evil. It is simply not helpful. We, as the wise Chinese farmer pointed out, we can't establish that. We can never settle down at, well, ultimately, well, what is good or bad? And if you look carefully at that, you'll notice it always seems to have something to do with you. Well, yeah, there's a guy like this, good, that strikes me, I don't like that over there, though. You're in the picture, you see. For the awakened have awakened to the fact that they don't really find anybody here. Which is really true for all of us, but when we're confused, we don't notice that. But if you can start framing things in good and bad, that self starts appearing there in the picture. What is good for me? What is bad for me? What is good for my people? What is bad for my people? That sort of thing. It starts to go, this endlessly goes on with us. And to awaken is to start noticing that. To realize that, and to realize, it isn't very productive, very helpful, very enlightening to frame things this way. It doesn't help. We remain caught in this endless quagmire, and a parliament of philosophers are not going to figure it out or get us out of this. Not through argumentation, much more just grasping more things and more things and more things. We can get out of this in an instant by realizing the nature of reality, the situation that we are in. And so then we can put this then in a different, if we have to, and because we are graspable creatures, and because I am giving a talk, and so I am setting out ideas and concepts, not really intending for you to now hang on to these, but just to help turn things over in your mind. We're going to just throw things out here. Let's just turn this over, look at this a little bit. So instead of framing things now in terms of good and bad, and I've talked about this many times, I'm just kind of stressing the point now this morning. We can frame it up simply in terms of the whole, this totality that I spoke of. The Buddhas always see things in terms of totality, in terms of wholeness, in which there isn't any center to this. It isn't everywhere everything is weighed off against one thing, and of course it's always me at the center here. No, we can see things in terms of this totality means that we don't find anything like that. We don't find any one thing that is, remember those of you that might have taken the course on totality last winter. Any one point you want to pick up can function just as well as the center as any other point. And so for relative discussion or temporary helpfulness in a given situation or whatever, it might be useful, functional to do that, but then I'll let it go because ultimately it's a big mistake to hang on to that because reality isn't structured that way. So the awakened, they don't see things in terms of good and bad. They'll see things in terms of wholeness because that is what they're always coming out of. And now in seeing things in terms of wholeness, now we can also see what contrasts with that or what the confusion is. And the confusion is to think that somehow we have a fractured world, a divided world. A world of this and that, where the different things of the world have distinct and separate realities. that are distinct and separate and apart from each other, and that they persist, enduring through time. Well, they come and they go, but they persist for a time and then they go. Ooh, the self, me, I'm one of those things too, right? And we start to tremble and we're back to the confusion again. But the awakened, they see this whole picture out of totality. Totality is what is always there. And the things that are coming and going, we can't dismiss those things. They certainly appear to be there, don't they? Me and the floor here and you guys out there and all, you know. It's always appearing there, something. So we don't dismiss that, but in seeing it in terms of totality, there's the reality. And we don't find a substantial reality, a truly graspable reality in the particulars, in the things. And were we to grasp any one thing there, that is what we now call unwholesome. Of course, we think of maybe wholesome as sort of a goody-goody kind of way of looking. Oh, this is wholesome. Wonder Bread is wholesome bread. Something that just, but it has kind of a sweet, goody-goody kind of flavor to it. That's not. We're just talking about the wholeness. And the unwholesome, oh, that's not good, it's not healthy. Yeah, well, yeah, maybe not, actually. But it isn't like, oh-ish bad. It is just that there's the different things framed out in the world here, including yourself. These aren't necessarily bad. But when mishandled, when we don't understand the true nature of what it is that's unfolding here, the appearances of things coming and going, we get caught by all of those, and we've forgotten all about wholeness, totality, that which is always there. Whatever I say is comes short of it, but we lose sight of that, and we keep reaching for the this and the that, trying to work it out somehow with the this, and forgetting all about, not noticing, oblivious to reality as a whole, or I could just say reality. And then we might wonder why we suffer. Why can't we finally answer the little girl? Well, why did we even give her that dualistic notion? Why can't you be good instead of naughty? Instead of maybe helping her see that behaving in ways that come out of a fractured view of the world, in the end, is kind of painful. It's painful for the little girl. It's difficult for the parents. Just continues to reach out into all aspects of our life. Help the little girl. Of course, she's a little girl. You can't give her any subtle stuff here like that all at once, but you can help her to notice when she's behaving in a particular way, a selfish kind of way. There's a lot of unhappiness, a lot of disturbance in the world surrounding that. Of course, as parents or as adults, maybe offering some hints as to how to live a sane and peaceful life, a just and moral life. And maybe we need to make that effort ourselves as well, because the little girl, the little boy, the children, they are watching. They're watching us. So we owe it to them, we owe it to each other, we owe it to ourselves to wake up, to just come back to this wholeness, this totality, out of which we are truly living. In fact, that really is our life when we see it properly. Our life is not our own. Our life is the life of the world. We're not separate and apart or distinct or different from anything or anyone. We'll label those people over there as something different. Well, now there's going to be trouble. We forget the basic things. They have the same dreams and concerns for themselves, for their children, for the world. They breathe the same air, drink the same water, walk on the same earth. Well, we don't notice these things because they start reaching out into this wholeness kind of thing, and it's hard to frame all that up. But boy, the differences, we can spot those. And we amplify those, and we live out of those. And that's just a rat's nest of trouble. Well, I shouldn't say a rat's nest. That's disparaging of rats. I don't mean to do that. Rats are included in this picture too. Well, maybe that's, I guess that's all I wanted to say about that point, but maybe you have some questions. Yes?
Since I've been reading the text, the ancient text, and sometimes things that you give out, I find words that are sort of highly nuanced and sort of have a double entendre. But in terms of totality, you take the word unwholesome, and you can say, okay, that the child's actions are unwholesome actions. But it also has this nuance or this other understanding that it's not belonging to the whole.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's precisely it. Yeah, those actions don't belong to the whole. And that's why they're going to embroil the little girl as well as her parents and then others in dukkha, to just put it in short terms. Yeah, it's not of the whole. And so what I'm saying then is, and it might be a little difficult with the little girl, but little by little, and if the parents are living out of this understanding themselves, just going back into the larger space, I'll get outside of your small ego, your little self, where your petty concerns. Parents start living in this way, the little girl will notice that. She'll start, she doesn't have to have some philosophical underpinning to all of this. She can start to learn this. And later on, perhaps, maybe, but on a more sophisticated level, you can begin to look into, well, why is this so? But even so, this doesn't come down to any deep, profound, subtle, and nuanced philosophical argument. It is simply a matter of seeing and then finding some simple language to point this out, which is difficult to do, not because it is so subtle and nuanced and all the rest of it, it's because we so deeply believe and live out of self, out of other, out of want, dislike, all of that. And it is difficult for us to realize, not only do we not have to live this way, it doesn't even match reality. And there's no happiness in it. There's no justice. There's no compassion, wisdom. All of that is lacking. So these are things that we can point out. And we make that effort to live that way ourselves. When we start to catch on to this, we start to notice, there is this other way of living. And then we can make an attempt to live that way. That's why we take the precepts. Does it mean that we're never going to ever lie or steal or this sort of thing? No, because you can't really say that. I mean, great, if you take the precepts and from that point on you never violate one. Well, that's wonderful, but I've never known anyone like that. But that's not the spirit and the understanding by which this should be taken up. That would be like a commandment. You can't do that, Well, no, we frame it up like this, where to do this, take what is not given, we say. Well, that doesn't mean now you're bad, you violated, maybe you violated it, but all it means is that what is the violation? Well, you've stepped off the path. You're not living as one who's living out of wholeness or one who's making this effort to turn their mind back to wholeness, that in each moment to wake up. So it's a very gentle kind of way. It's not dictatorial. It's not forcing anybody into anything. It's just a reminder to bring ourselves back. And even what I talked about today is, well, why should we do this again? Well, it's this matter of dukkha and release from dukkha. That's at stake here. If that's important to you, well, here's your reason why. But in the end, we even get rid of that. As I said, in the end, finally the Buddhas are silent. They don't say anything in the end. Because we can't say, but we can point these things out, and we can point these things out to the little girl. But if you tell the little girl, good, why can't you be good and not naughty? Or, well, what are we even talking about, good, naughty? And why should I? When I want to be naughty, why should I be? And we, as he says, there's no way to answer that in the end. We can't. But if we understand in terms of wholeness and totality and this reality that we're living out of, well, here's going to be your reason, except the Buddhas don't live out of a reason for this. To see this is to let it all drop away and all the argumentation. So another point, I got a little off on the tangent, but the point I was trying to make is that this does not involve any deep profound philosophical argumentation here. And the little girl can understand. And the best way to help that little girl understand is not to tell her really anything, but just to make that effort to live that way yourself. We have the story of the antique dealer teaching the apprentice what is a masterpiece. But the antique dealer can't really tell you what exactly is a masterpiece. Can't really say. Every time you say something, the whole thing starts to just... that's going back into our frameworked world. Where you have it all. Can you spell that out for me? And let me take some notes here right now. And everything starts getting framed up. And we think maybe we're going to get a hold of stuff this way. We're getting the information and all of that. But what we don't understand is that we've left reality behind. And if we want to understand a masterpiece, this is not the way to go about doing that. So the antique dealer, the master antique dealer, just brings in a masterpiece every day to the apprentice, brings him into an empty room with just one masterpiece. I don't know what it was, furniture or something, I don't know what, but doesn't matter. But a masterpiece of some sort. And the apprentice looks it over, and he does this every day. He never tells him anything about it. One masterpiece after another. And this goes on for years. This is training. What kind of training? You're not even talking to me. You know, but eventually maybe the student might start losing his anxiety about, well, you're not really teaching me anything. You're not really showing me anything here. I mean, it just keeps showing me this. But you don't tell me what I'm supposed to look at. And you know, but maybe eventually he starts to calm down. He's looking at one masterpiece after another. It kind of just goes on this way. This is pointing out something about wholeness. If he says anything, it's going to be fractured. You start making the rules here. Live out of that. Well, they should have this kind of leg on that kind of table or whatever, you know. No, you just look at this, look at this, look at this. And then finally, after a number of years, maybe the antique dealer realizes the student has learned something here. The demeanor, the approach, the way the student is. So one day, the master figures the student is ready. So the master brings in a fake. Instantly, the student walks in the room and recognizes the fake. Well, what do they recognize there? Well, we can't say. We want to know. We want to grasp that. We want to hang on to that. But in the end, there's really nothing even to say about that. But we can learn to spot delusion. We can learn to see that. But we see that it's helpful for us to bring ourselves back to this practice, to learn to settle our minds so we can be here and be present, to come back to these subtle teachings again and again, to just turn them over, to turn them over. In the end, well, what should I walk away with? Well, nothing, really. As Suzuki Roshi said, when my talk's over, your listening's over. No need to remember. Because it's in the churning it over and turning it over. It's in the coming into the room with the masterpiece sitting there and looking at that. So we acquaint ourselves with this practice and with these teachings over and over and over again. Of course, unlike the in this little enclosed story of the antique dealer, of course, it's probably true too. The student, the apprentice, then leaves and is out in the busy world again, and that's what happens to us here too. But in essence, that is kind of what this is. In the end, like, for example, I can't teach you anything about this. You just have to see for yourself. Basically, all I can do is help point out what you need to be looking for and maybe what you should maybe consider avoiding, but try to give you some understanding of maybe why to avoid that. But in the end, I can't say. So it's a very subtle thing, and it takes patience. So I have great respect for those of you who just keep coming back to this and coming back to this and coming back to this. Because that is what we need to do. And it gets a little frustrating at times, I know. Same thing with my teacher, just coming back, coming, looking at him every day. And in the end, what? I don't know. But it can become very clear. This is delusion. This is not delusion. This is of wholesome mind. This is fractured mind. That could become clear. Then we need to practice And we can practice before that becomes clear for us. Just go ahead and practice. It's very helpful. Because then when we start to, we start to notice what that fractured mind is and how we manifest that we're living out of that so easily. We slip into that. Now we practice. Practice to bring ourselves back to just this. We learn to do that. But we don't practice with the idea that somehow we're going to get anywhere with this. But we need just simply to work it. As Dogen said, you know, since we're already Buddha anyway, well then why practice? That was his question. Until he realized at some point, well, yes, we're Buddha, but if you don't manifest that, if you don't live out of that, well, it's as if we're living out of a delusional being. So it's kind of like that. I don't know if I answered you. I probably went far from it there, but for the little girl, the little children, you know, it's so easy to be dictatorial, and maybe at times you need to say that. Don't play in the street. Okay, you make a, you know, sometimes you have to do that. But okay, but then there's a time where you let that go. But by and large, it's what we're teaching them. And we're doing this inadvertently anyway, by the way. As I said, you are the antique dealer in front of your children, that sort of thing. You are showing them something day after day, but what are you showing them? We might think we can be kind of cavalier about this. Doesn't matter. But that's what they're learning. What do you want them to learn? Having children around in the household like that is very helpful for us to watch ourselves. Because if you're really concerned about that, how that little person now is being formed and shaped and is going to grow into an adult, you know, all of that is forming there. You start to realize how much of it, and it isn't just in what you tell them or, you know, what school you send them off to and this sort of thing. It is really what you show them day after day as the antique dealer. You're bringing something into the room and showing them every day, day after day. And of course, this doesn't just end with the little children. In every aspect of our life, this sort of thing is going on. But at some point, we can realize that, and that is where we can bring ourselves back to noticing this. And most of all, then, in the end, what it really comes down to is just watch your own mind. Because your action, your speech, everything is going to be coming out of that. And we can slip off, and I'll come back. When you realize that, just come back. Don't say anything. It's all right. Just come back. No judgment. You can't judge the other. Don't judge yourself. Discern what is taking place there. Realize what's taking place. Now just come back and shut up. Don't say anything. Just come back. That's all. And do it. Do that over. That's it. That's the most important thing. Wake up. In the next moment, wake up again. Well, I know. I really gave a whole other talk out of this. So I probably have just a little bit. Yes?
Actually, there's another whole talk. I was wondering if you could clarify. I think the agreed upon phrasing there is a subtlety to, I think, what I heard, which was the question. Not of the whole,
mm-hmm.
And maybe you could clarify that there really isn't anything outside of the whole. In our experience, there is nothing outside of the whole. So technically,
okay, yes, yeah. If you hear me saying something like not of the whole, I'm not now talking about, well, here's the whole, and that, so it's not of the whole. It's somewhere else over here. There's no such thing as that. Okay, you have to understand. So I say not of the whole. What I mean by that is. You have action that is not of the whole. That means an action that is not coming out of an awareness, a consideration of the whole. It is coming out of self, out of part, out of, you know, it doesn't mean that it's coming from somewhere else other than the whole, because there is no, there's just this reality. There's not some other thing over there that's not, you know, because if there were, it would be this reality. So it can't be otherwise. There's nothing outside of mind, as we say in Zen, same kind of teaching there. When I say not of the whole, means coming out of a fractured mind, a divisive mind, a selfish mind, a ego-oriented, you know, mind, that sort of thing. That's what I'm speaking of, not talking about something other than the whole, because there isn't it. And as I said before, the whole, this is reality. And we're never apart from that. So we can always find it. We can always come back to that. Find it, isn't it? It's wherever you look. But it's a matter of, as I said before, watch your mind. Because it is in your mind that we confuse ourselves, that we drift away, that we start boxing things up. And that might be functional and useful under limited circumstances, fine. But we forget that and we take all of that as reality. And now we live out of dukkha once again. So I don't know, did I clarify that? Yeah, Scott.
So one form of dukkha, of course, is wanting to be done. But a form of dukkha that I sometimes get caught in or struggle with is wanting to be good.
Well, it's just the same thing, really, in the end. Yeah, wanting to be something, you know. Wanting an identity or wanting to be, yeah, I want to be good. I want to be a good Zen student so I can become enlightened or, you know, something like this. And then I can live free of this pain. But that's to be caught in that very framework once again. So, yeah, this isn't about wanting to be good. In that case, then, wanting to be good is that we have the idea, we're operating on the idea that good is some particular thing. But good isn't some particular thing. Good, it really is the whole, once again. It's the reality itself as a whole, which is not a thing. We can't get outside of it to get hold of it as a thing. It is not a thing at all. So there's no point in wanting that. On the other hand, there is this subtle desire to be free of dukkha. Okay, and it does involve that. So you say, well, isn't that like wanting the whole? Yeah. Now we're drifting into an area where words just aren't going to convey this. But what we need to do, as I said, watch. This is the key. Watch your mind. What are we watching for? Well, watch your mind grasping. Well, and so we start going off into these more and more subtle spaces. Well, then what? But what I've already pointed out too is that, well, in the end, we can't say. The antique dealer can't tell you what's a masterpiece. But we can see that. We can realize that without grasping. And in the end, that's what we need to do. So we just watch the mind, see ourselves drifting on. And whether it's that I want to be good, I want to be enlightened, I want, you know, whatever. Start to see that for what it is. Notice what you're doing there. It is grasping. It is leaning. Realize what that is. That is dukkha. That is frustration. That is confusion. That is endless pain. And so that is our usual, we're so used to that because that's, we live out of that all the time. But we can realize that, you know, you just see that for what it is and realize we don't have to live out of that. We can live in freedom of that. But we can only live in freedom of that if we realize what we're doing and that we don't have to do that. It's probably late enough. No other question, maybe I should end it here. It's getting late. Uh-oh, wait, yes.
The truth and the whole is the same thing.
Yes, well, we talk about two truths. There's relative truth and then absolute truth or truth itself. Yes, that is the whole.
Okay.
Yeah. And we designate those, at least I do, with a capital T and a small t for relative truth. And there's some controversy around these teachings, but the controversy only arises in people who are confused. For the awakened, it is quite. There are these two truths. Yeah. Anyway, there's a whole book there. So, anyway, I better end it. But thank you.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.